Do you like comics? We're here to talk comics. This is the Superhuman Registration Podcast.
They really are. Although I will say, as you know, speaking as a new dad whose kid has just gotten into Elmo and Sesame Street, Elmo hate is overblown. Maybe the character was more annoying 10 years ago, but nowadays he's kind of fine.
Wait, people hate Elmo?
Oh, people are livid over Elmo. Elmo does anything vaguely positive on Twitter, and it's just, you will not hear the end of it for days.
Oh,
you gotta mute Jordan Peterson if you haven't done that already.
I don't count those as people.
Yeah, those are trolls. I just thought, I mean, he's kind of annoying, and I miss Bert and Ernie. That's, you know, they were like stars of the show when I was watching, and now it's all about Elmo.
I surprisingly remember a lot about Grover, but I think Grover was a little bit more prominent in Mexican Sesame Street.
He's definitely the best. Like, Grover and Gonzo are my favorite Muppets from, you know, Sesame Street and Muppet Show.
I never understood why my parents, like when I was growing up, refused to acknowledge Big Bird. And it's not that they refused to acknowledge his existence. Is that to them, he didn't exist. Because we grew up with Abelardo, who is Big Bird's Mexican cousin.
That's so crazy. Would they have like separate scenes with him or something? Or was he just called?
I don't remember. But he's a different character entirely. Like, there is a Big Bird family tree, because in every country, or most countries, there is a different Big Bird that takes his place.
Seriously?
I knew that there was one in Mexico, but I didn't know that was, like, universal.
I'm trying to remember who has the scary one.
Who has the scary Big Bird?
Yeah.
What? Why is there a scary
Why would you make a scary Big Bird?
They're called ostriches. We already have those.
The entire point of Big Bird is that he's, like, this giant child. Why would you make a big, scary baby?
Is he the Brazilian one?
The Brazilian one is probably a sexy Big Bird.
Yeah, honest. He's Brazilian. His name is Garibaldo. Here, I'll just put up the...
All right, let's take a look at this guy.
You have to scroll down to international cousins.
Big Bird's family. A Muppet wiki. This is delightful.
This is our podcast now. It's just reading this wiki.
Hey, listen, I really like Muppets. Why you is know, Big Bird's dad like his feathers are like loot? This is terrifying.
Abelardo.
Nanny Bird.
Oh, Garibaldo. Oh my gosh, yeah. He does look like something out of Five Nights at Freddy's.
Yeah, he's terrifying.
Holy
crap. Is Uncle
crap.
Slim holding
Why are his
a
eyes
gun?
Red? Why are his eyes red?
Don't know.
Who are we looking? Garibaldo. I haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, you have to
Garibaldo.
You have to go to International Cousins, which is below, like, the first section.
Oh, I went too far. Oh, good gracious.
Yes, that is the appropriate response.
Yeah, children grew up with that, and that's more terrifying, which explains a lot about Brazil now that I think about it.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, he's like going to break into the favela and eat your family.
Yeah.
Goodness.
Granted, my two frames of reference for Brazil are YouTube videos of Carnival and the Fast and the Furious movies. So take that with a grain of salt, I guess.
I want to go back to Uncle Slim, and I'm trying to see. No, that's just, he has a cowboy hat, but not a gun. It looked like he had a gun in his hand. What is that? A ping pong paddle? He has some sort of like accessory on his side, and I can't decide what it is.
Who are you talking about?
Uncle Slim, Big Bird's uncle. Yeah.
Oh,
I don't know what he has on his hip, but
I'm not gonna lie, he looks like he would have not very great political views at the Thanksgiving
dinner
table.
Oh gosh.
All I'm saying is we gotta take our country back. From who, Uncle Slim? No one's taking it.
Okay.
He's a
cow, you know,
bird
what?
From Wyoming.
Yep. Or yellow birds. I didn't realize we were yellow. Oh, you can't say that. You can't say that, Uncle Slim.
Oh, that's our word. What do you mean?
Okay, you know what? All of this talk of like scary children's show characters and bad politics. We need a palate cleanser. I think we should segue directly from here into talking about a violent massacre of dead presidents.
That sounds like such a good band name.
The Violent Massacre of Dead Presidents.
Yeah.
You can keep that one.
I'm gonna.
Hey, everybody. It's the Superhuman Registration Podcast. We read some comics, and we're here to talk about those comics. My name is Steven. I've got John and Aldo with me tonight. You guys doing okay? You keeping warm?
Hey. Eating
good?
Hey.
Yes, warm and eating good.
Good. Glad to hear it. We're here to talk about comics, and I think that we should start with the Deadpool story.
Sure. I was lucky enough to dibs that one, and it's a very easy summary. But we read Deadpool from 2012, the first five issues, the Dead President's arc, written by Brian Posehn, Jerry Duggan, and artist was Tony Moore. Brian Posehn, if you don't know his stand-up comedy, you've seen him as a bit part in every TV show or movie ever. So, I think I spotted him in Seinfeld one time. He's in New Girl, just about everything. I don't know. He's really funny. But the issue starts with a necromancer bringing back some presidents from the dead, hoping that they can help straighten out the country. And instead, they come back as really pissed off zombies that want to destroy everything. And so a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent puts Agent Preston in charge, and she's got to clean it up, good, bad, or whatever. It's all on her shoulders, and she decides after Captain America decapitates Truman and they get it on camera that they don't want to be connected with it. They don't want to have a scene while they're fighting zombie presidents. And so Deadpool gets involved, as he had been in the area doing his Deadpool thing, bursting out of a big monster with Thor. He, in descending order of popularity, kills the presidents, or re-kills the presidents, and he's helped by a ghost, Benjamin Franklin, who is on the prowl for ladies or for food, because he's a ghost made out of electricity and he misses both. But anything, any little factoid you know about the presidents is used as a joke. Taft, I don't know if he was our fattest president, but according to this comic, he was. Is stuck in a bathtub most of it and uses that to get around. Lincoln is featured prominently with a lot of wrestling. There's a gag about Washington's teeth. And eventually, Deadpool is able to defeat them. But Agent Preston, unfortunately, is killed in the process. And the necromancer, trying to make things all better, this S.H.I.E.L.D. agent named Michael, he ends up putting her consciousness into Deadpool, and that leads into the next arc, where not only do we have Deadpool's usual inner monologue, we also have her comments on it. So I realized when I got to the end of this series that, oh, I've read that part of it, but this is just a wacky story, very violent, very bloody. It's a Deadpool story, so of course you're going to get that, but you also get silly little run-ins with our country's presidents, at least the dead ones, that is. What did you all think?
So Deadpool is basically just the Family Guy of the MCU. That's kind of what I'm taking from this.
I don't know. Like, running gags or
it's
what?
It's just a lot of, like, non-sequiturs, pop culture references, little bit of edginess, you know, for the kids. And I don't like it. So it's just like Family Guy.
Yeah, this is a reminder of why I don't like solo Deadpool books. Deadpool's fine. I think I like Deadpool in a team, like X-Force books. I would maybe say, I would venture to guess I might enjoy him in, like, Deadpool and Cable. But him leading a book, I find them obnoxious. The book is fine. Like, the story's funny. A lot, there's so many jokes. There's like a joke per page. I would estimate there's like a joke to every two panels in this book, and not all of them are good. I would argue most of them are okay. But yeah, I don't know. I like the premise. The premise is fun. Deadpool, you know, being the not a hero. He's just being, you know, the D-bag that they need, because, you know, they're not so worried about his public appearance to kill the presidents. Yeah. Like, all that stuff's funny. Like, it's really good stuff. I think just so much of the dialogue. Just so much of the dialogue I just don't vibe with.
You didn't like the naming this random Agent Michael just so they could, like, shove in a Arrested Development quote?
I've never seen Arrested Development, so that went over my head.
Oh. Well, it was in there. And you should see at least the first three seasons. I haven't seen the newest stuff that got put on Netflix, but the originals yeah, were really good. So anyway,
I don't know. I don't think Arrested Development's aged super well.
I haven't gone back and watched it, but
I also think I counted no less than three Ghostbusters references.
True. I mean, he was fighting ghosts, so you know, who are you gonna call? What are you gonna do about it? No, you guys seem like bothered by this, and I was like, eh, this is dumb, this is fun, whatever. But you guys seem like you didn't enjoy it as much as me. That's too bad. I thought we were going to be like, oh, like, Deadpool, what a funny guy. Oh, yeah, not all these jokes were winners, but like, what a fun read. And oh, the little bits of obscure trivia were funny in there, weren't they? Ah, yes. Anyway, back to serious comics.
They would be great. Like, all of the little trivia jokes, all of the little puns, all of that would be great if it wasn't being thrown at me like 100 million miles an hour every page. I hate to say that Steven's right, but I feel like Steven's right about that Family Guy comparison.
I never get tired of hearing people say Steven's right. Also, why do you hate saying it? What's wrong? What's wrong with me being right?
It implies that...
I like being right. Don't you like me being right?
It implies that other people, meaning me and Aldo, could be wrong if you're right. So that is a bummer.
Well, you don't have to be wrong. You could just agree with me.
I don't know, man. That's a tall order. But I enjoyed the art style. I thought it was loose and fun in a way that matched the tone of the book.
I didn't get a chance to look it up, and I'm 3 inches away from a keyboard and computer, but I'm pretty sure that Tony Moore was the original artist for The Walking Dead, if I'm not mistaken. Oh.
Now that you've said that, that makes sense, and that sounds true, so I'm going to look it up, because now I've said that it sounds true, we have to verify.
All the stuff on Marvel Unlimited is...
First 6 issues of Walking Dead.
There you go.
Yeah, so he was the original artist, and then I think there was some creative differences, some payment stuff. I can't remember the specifics of it. He left The Walking Dead, and it was quickly, obviously, replaced, because they did, you know, 300 more issues of that cycle of, let's show up somewhere, let's screw up the place, and let's leave. So yeah, but really good artist. I do remember reading that number one, because Image likes to do those. I think Marvel also does them, like they reprint the number ones at like a very cheap price, like 99 cents.
Yeah,
and they did that for The Walking Dead quite a few times, especially as like the AMC show was starting up and then, you know, doing really well. So I remember seeing that first issue a lot and really liking the art on it. And, you know, that follows here. The art is fun. It's colorful. It is chaotic. It's energetic. It's really well done. I like the art in here.
It's overall pretty easy to follow, too, which is important when you have a comic with as much frenetic action and, you know, slapstick violence as Deadpool. Yeah. All of the gore, all of the splatter, like, it actually can make things difficult to read. The carnage is
no legible. This is, yeah, this is Deadpool, not Carnage.
Why is that so good?
I can understand how you'd be mistaken.
They both wear red.
They're both red and black. Yeah. And they both kill.
Yeah, a lot of violence.
Yeah, but...
I would get mad at you, except just invoking the name Carnage made me think about Absolute Carnage, because I've been thinking about all of the dad comics that I really like recently, so it actually puts me in a pretty mellow mood.
Oh, so that was an absolute win.
That's the Hulk.
I wanted to go back to Deadpool as a part of X-Force. Like, that his type of character, like a mercenary, you know, a guy who's... you know, really just a hitman when you boil down to the essentials. He doesn't strike you as like a sore thumb, you know, in a more serious kind of violent book like that or a team like that. Cause it seems like, yeah, that's what he does. But like, he's always joking around and stuff. And his fourth wall breaks don't really work, I think, outside of his own books. Why do you think he works better when he's like part of a team like that?
Because there's less of him to like take the spotlight, which sounds, I don't know, real
just mean, sounds like I you guess. Don't like him at all.
I actually funnily enough, I've never been a big fan of Deadpool. Mm-hmm. I was surprised I like the Deadpool movies as much as I do, and I feel like 90% of that is Ryan Reynolds.
I mean, yes.
Yes.
The guy just like ekes charisma. So,
yeah, but the Deadpool movies also make a really good point of having him not necessarily take up the screen real estate all of the time. They pair him up with like a straight character. They pair him up with like just all of these other people who have to deal with him.
Yeah.
So he has other people to bounce off of. Not that he's completely solo in here, but the agent, Preston, who recruits him, she's not really around a whole lot. She shows up for a couple pages, like, every issue, and then, you know, dips, lets him... Because I don't blame her. Nobody really wants to hang around Deadpool that much.
He's a lot.
Yeah, the Necromancer doesn't really stick around a whole lot. Doctor Strange doesn't stick around for a whole lot. Like, nobody sticks around a whole lot. So, it is Deadpool carrying a lot of the dialogue all of the time.
Yeah.
And his repertoire with the presidents is the exact same... type of dialogue. It's puns, it's jokes, it's references. The only difference is the presidents have a theme and Deadpool just kind of pulls out of whatever.
Yeah.
So that's it for me. And basically when he's on a team book, specifically like X-Force, because that's like, I think the only stuff I've read him in, and Spider-Man, he has like a straight character, or he has other people to kind of, you know, help carry the story so that it's not always this kind of nonsense stuff happening all the time. And I think there, specifically with the X-Force books, there is a limit to how much they do kind of the wacky zaniness. Like, he's not doing the fourth wall breaks all of the time in those books. Again, mostly because he has to share the spotlight. So I think like that's what works. So I like him in small doses, but like just pure concentrated Deadpool. I don't like the pulp.
So I'm struggling with something here because I'm kind of on the same page as Aldo. But like other characters with a similar sort of approach to storytelling and a similar tendency towards quips don't get on my nerves as much. Like Spider-Man, right? Spider-Man gets in fights and he quips and he does all of that stuff. And I rarely find myself annoyed by Spider-Man's presence the way that Deadpool annoys me. And I'm trying to come up with an explanation as to why that is. That's not just, I don't like these jokes, they're not funny. Because on the one hand, Brian Posehn is a comedian, right? This is what he does. And whether the comedy's to my taste or not, he's pretty good at that. So I don't want to, like, knock the man's craft necessarily. But, I don't know. I think I'm not satisfied with the explanation that it's just unrelenting. However, while I was reading the book, I was thinking of a comment that Lindsay Ellis made in a video essay before she quit YouTube about Mel Brooks. and how Mel Brooks kept throwing joke after joke after joke after joke in his movies. And if you didn't like one, you didn't have to wait that long for the next one to come along. Mm-hmm. And like, I thought of that while reading this, and it's just like, none of these are landing for me. Not one. I don't know that I actually laughed once in this comic. And that might just be me being a curmudgeon.
I mean, we shouldn't discount that. But...
No, we absolutely should not. I cannot wait until it is socially acceptable for me to go outside in a boxer shorts and robe and yell at people to get off my
lawn. Yeah, the temperature needs to...
Be the change you want to see in the world.
No, the kids who play on my lawn are actually really nice. But here's the other thing that I was thinking when I was reading this book. I feel like I've read this story before. Like, it's a story about Benjamin Franklin, who is advising our protagonist, a sword-wielding psychopath who mows down just row after row of expendable goons. Like, isn't that Dr. McNinja?
That is Dr. McNinja, except that was not the ghost of Ben Franklin. It is a clone, and he was his...
That's right, it was a clone.
He was his mentor from college. And Dr. McNinja is a medical professional. He's not a, you know, sword-wielding psychopath. Yes,
he's a ninja with swords who murders people.
He murders bad guys or defeats kids who are afflicted with Paul Bunyan disease, but he heals them so they shrink back down to regular-sized kids. It's a very... Come on. These little distinctions are subtle but very important in separating, you know, different arts.
What you're highlighting here is that I just really wish that this story had been written by Christopher Hastings.
Yes.
And that's not fair. That's not fair. But again, it is like, I feel like I read this story.
Yeah.
Or something very, very similar to it. And I liked the other version better.
Yeah.
Jeez, when did this... This came out more recently than I thought it did.
2012. Yeah.
That's not that recent. That's 12 years ago.
Oof.
Yeah.
You mean 12 years ago wasn't
but
the
Dr.
90s?
Ninja,
oh, no!
But the thing is, like, in my head, they're contemporaneous. That Dr. McNinja and this story were out at kind of the same time. Mm-hmm. But no, Dr. McNinja was started in 2005.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I think it probably hit its heyday around, like, 2009, 2010. Technically, it went until 2017. That book ran a lot longer than I thought it
yeah,
did.
Yeah, they had a lot of arcs, wow. And it's great. I really love Dr. McNinja. I need to go through and have a reread because it just cracks me up. And one of those that, you know, gives me hope for finally doing my own webcomic where even though, like, the art doesn't start off as the best, it gets, like, pretty great by the end, like, decent, you know. And it's hope for those of us who don't draw as well as we want to. But anyway.
John, if you ever want to feel really good about your art, look up the original One Punch Man webcomic.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's so bad.
Yeah, so it got picked up to be a comic, but they hired a different artist. Yusuke Murata, who is amazing. But... the original webcomic, it looks like it was... And no disrespect to the guy. The guy is not a trained professional. I think he just... He needed to find a way to get his story out, and he was the tool. And it was not a very polished or trained or refined tool. A lot of it looks like it was drawn by, like, a 10-year-old. Which sounds like an insult, but I promise it's not.
It kind of is. It kind of is.
Yeah. It is a bit of an insult.
It's a testament to how fun his stories are that they actually wound up getting better quality artists and anime adaptations and stuff.
Oh, gosh.
Because they're... Yeah.
Yeah, this is a mess.
Yeah. So, you know, anything's possible. Don't feel bad about your art. You can do it.
Thanks,
that's the takeaway here.
No, I mean, good or bad, the artist who actually can finish a project is light years ahead of everyone else who's like, meh. Right now I'm in the meh. Camp,
yep.
But... Yep. Yep.
Anyhow.
At the end of the day, half the work is doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was entertained
by this.
And this
book was not doing it.
But it gets, yeah, I'm in the minority here. Maybe, Stephen, this doesn't land, this humor doesn't land as well, because with a Spider-Man book, there's a level of fun that you're going to have almost guaranteed with most Spider-Man books, and you're already in favor of Spider-Man. You're more on his side, and the same kind of goodwill that you would extend to someone who you love and admire, maybe they're in a play and you don't really think it's that good, but you're going to give them the benefit of the doubt and laugh along with them and then be won over eventually, that maybe that's Spider-Man. And then Deadpool, like, it's a little gross and there's jokes on top of it, so it's harder to get into the, you know, get into a mood where you can put up with the quips and the one-liners and, you know, the annoying little jokes that maybe it's the same joke, but when Deadpool tells it, it's not as funny as Spider-Man. I don't know. Maybe just you like one better than the other, and so you're more likely to you know, have those jokes land. I don't know.
You know what else there might be to it?
I think for me, it really is just kind of how unrelenting it is. It's kind of like, I like sugar. I like chocolate. But if I ate chocolate, like, morning, day, and night, and the snacks in between, and chocolate milk for all of my drinks, I would get tired of it. Just constantly. Get sick of it. So for me, it really is a lot of the fact that there's not a lot of room to breathe. Just because it's a comedy book doesn't mean it has to be 100% comedy on every page. You can take a moment to breathe and let, like, your really good jokes land.
You know, the other piece to it, I think, is that when you have a Spider-Man story, it's not just joke after joke after joke after joke. Because as important to Spider-Man as the humor and the dust-ups with the villains, which, by the way, dust-up is not a term that I actually use in real life, but I use it a lot when I'm talking on this podcast.
We're not going to, like, follow you around and check, is. Like, is he using his regular words today? Don't worry.
A big part of what makes Spider-Man a compelling character is the fact that he has a personal life. And there is stuff going on in his personal life that informs the way he acts as a superhero and vice versa. There's the internal tension, you know, all the stuff that made Spider-Man a popular character and such a deviation from what we had seen from superheroes to that point. And Deadpool, when he does have that, it feels forced. Like, when at the end, when Deadpool is, like, done making jokes, he says, I'm done making jokes because you killed my friend. I didn't believe it, because I didn't really get the sense that he cared what this woman thought about him at all.
It felt like a setup to another punchline.
Which it wound up being, mm-hmm. ultimately. Mm-hmm. And again, it's like, I don't want to be too harsh on this book, just because I do think ultimately it just isn't for me. Not that it's bad. It's not my type of humor. It reminds me more of Marvel Zombies than I would like it to. And I, despite the fact that I'm one of the ones who insists we read it every year, I don't particularly like Marvel Zombies.
Then as a masochist, yeah, reading this, like, book you don't like should have been more fun.
You would think. Yeah, so, like, I actually don't think that when it comes to the ranking, I'm going to put it super low, because I didn't hate it. I have enough objectivity here to be able to say this is a well-crafted book that I did not like. It was paced really well. The action was pretty clean and literate. When they did get into president jokes, sometimes they were really good. Reagan Star Wars was pretty good. A lot of the Abe Lincoln stuff was pretty good. The Nixon going nuts and destroying Watergate felt really good. Taft felt like a cheap shot.
Yeah.
Not gonna lie.
I think it's a lot of it is like, we're gonna make jokes about, you know, like, who you expect us to make jokes about. But, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I still laughed at some of those jokes that I saw coming a mile away. You know, Kennedy's dialogue, you know, written all out, you know, like as he would normally speak, was you know, silly to me, and I enjoyed that. But I think it was also because I like The Simpsons, where Mayor Quimby talks exactly like that. So,
yeah, and I think for me, it's the saturation kills the impact of the joke, because as funny as I do find the Taft thing, not just him being large and stuck in the tub, which is I guess like an urban myth of the White House was that that was a thing that happened. The joke about him using the bathtub as like his main mode of transportation, in without it being surrounded by, you know, 20 jokes a minute, I think I would have laughed harder than I did. Because a lot of the jokes in here did give me a really good chuckle, but a lot of my laughs were spent after the first issue.
He's like, how many more presidents do we have to get through?
There's that joke at the end too, where there, it's like the last couple of presidents, and there's like a little note that's like, oh, maybe we should have had this guy earlier in the book. Yeah, but who cares?
Yeah. Fillmore should have been killed with the guys in the last scene, but here we are.
Yeah. So, like, there's good jokes in here, and I'm not, like, personally, kind of like Steven, I agree. I don't think they're bad. There's a ton of bad jokes in here. I just think, at least for me, it's at the speed that they're coming out with. It's just, like, they lose their impact. And a lot of the stuff that's getting wild, it escalates, but without room to breathe, the escalation doesn't feel like it's escalating to comedic levels. It feels natural for this book, which I think is kind of a detriment. And maybe part of the problem here is that I read it all in one sitting. Maybe it would be funnier individual chapters at a time. But because, you know, you have time to breathe in between issues and you're able to like really be like, oh man, I wonder what hilarity he's going to get up to this time, you know, a month later and a month later and so on and so forth. And so maybe the whole idea of him going out into outer space would have felt like a better escalation. But I don't know. We in a handful of issues, we go from Teddy Roosevelt punching bears, which is funny.
I really like that, and actually.
Yeah. Yeah, same. I love that. I love Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah. He's
such a character. That by the time that we get up to that point, a lot of it just felt so fast. And again, maybe that's a problem with... Maybe this isn't necessarily meant for trades. Maybe this really was meant to be read an issue at a time.
Kind of like your other comics from your monthly pull. That's your, you know, your reading, and then this is like the funny pages. This is your dessert after you've, you know, we've had a real serious run with the Avengers. But now on the lighter side, we have Deadpool, you know, fighting Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lincoln getting to shoot him.
Yeah, because he's doing a lot of like Bugs Bunny stuff too.
Yeah.
Which is funny, but it all gets mixed up so much in all of this like mayhem, right? Because he's doing that Bugs Bunny thing where like he shows up next to Theodore Roosevelt and he's asking him like what he's doing and then shoots him in the face. And then he cross-dresses as Marilyn Monroe. And so like it's just like a lot of like really goofy stuff like that, right? Like he straps himself to like a piece of the rocket or something or the space station to land back on Earth. That's good stuff. It's just when you have so much of it mixed in together, I feel, at least when we lost the impact.
Another thing that's unambiguously good, the covers.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Those covers are so good. It's, what, Jeff Darrow was the artist on the covers?
I have to flip back, but I believe so.
Believe so, yeah. Who also didn't he do like, Cowboys versus Zombies or something like that? He did something versus something.
Yeah, I think he did a cowboy something.
Yeah.
But like I only know him from his cover art.
Same. Yeah, same.
And it's always fantastic. Yeah, no, just really good covers. That's all I got. They're Shaolin Cowboy.
That's what it is.
That's what it is. I've never read it.
I've only seen the cover.
I've seen it. Yeah. I'm looking at it, like he did work on Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot, which that got a cartoon show on Fox Kids for a while. Oh, I should see if I can track down a copy of that just to read it because I have no idea.
I forgot anything about that
it,
show.
Despite the fact that it was on TV when I was growing up. That was Frank Miller. Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot was Frank Miller and Jeff Darrow. I got to look that book up.
What?
That's not what the topic of this podcast is, but holy crap.
We have covered a lot of Deadpool. Is it time to move on to Ultraman?
I think it's time. Hold on. It will be time as soon as I pull the book up again.
Well, while you're looking, have you guys watched the new X-Men cartoon?
I've been purposely avoiding it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Because I'm just getting so tired of my childhood being sold back to me over and over and over again.
What, you mean this kind of thing has happened before? A dozen times by Disney in the last 5 years or less?
Yeah.
Or more, or no, more than that, really.
I never had that strong of an affinity to the X-Men TV show. I watched it a lot as a kid. I was never like a diehard fan of it.
Here's the thing. Every time we read an X-Men comic, in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh, this is a lot more mature and edgy than I'm used to X-Men being. Because the X-Men cartoon wasn't. Yeah. It was very edgy for a show for 7-year-olds.
Which is to say, not at all.
Yeah.
I mean, what they did manage to do was really impressive. Like, they killed off a main character in the first episode.
Yeah, Morph.
In a...
I thought he came back.
Network
later,
TV
though.
Environment. Yeah, he did, yes.
Okay.
But I don't think he came back for seasons. And it's like this is an era of network TV where you couldn't show guns. Like they had to be laser guns.
Yeah.
You could never like punch people, you could only punch robots.
Yeah.
Yeah, Wolverine never stabbed a person.
Wolverine never stabbed a person. And that's like his whole deal.
Yeah.
It's like, that's what's on his Tinder profile.
He's the best at what he
Wolverine,
does.
Wolverine, 600 years old, stabs people.
Yeah. So I haven't been
I'm
in
just here because Nightcrawler put me up to it, swipe left, and let me drink my beer.
So all that to say is I'll watch it at some point, but I'm not like in a hurry to watch it. I do think it's funny how...
I mean, same.
I do think it's funny how people were getting mad about the powerful bisexual energy radiating from Gambit as if... He's never had that strong bisexual energy that radiates off of him.
He didn't in the cartoon.
No, but I feel like his character design... I feel like... I don't know. In the comics, I feel like he's always had strong...
Oh, absolutely.
I feel like he'd be just as ready to seduce a man as he would be a woman. He wouldn't follow through, but he would totally do it.
Here's the thing. I think he would follow through, but also at the same time, like, Gambit is simultaneously just the term that I've read is disaster bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
And completely 100% monogamous in the tank for Rogue. And somehow he manages to do both. The end.
Sorry, I was trying to come up with some kind of Cajun accent, and it just wasn't working in my head, so I chickened out.
So Ultraman, right?
Yeah. Okay, so Marvel got the license to publish Ultraman comics, which are not, I don't believe, in continuity with the rest of the Ultraman universe, but they're kind of their own thing. They're also not part of Marvel continuity. So this is just Marvel Comics publishing a series of stories about Ultraman. Ultraman being, of course, a... famous Japanese tokusatsu character, and that's the genre of people in costumes fighting monsters who are actually people dressed up in costumes over top of cities which are actually models. Think Power Rangers. Tokusatsu is not a genre that I actually know that much about. I watched Power Rangers when I was a kid. I have seen a little bit of tokusatsu stuff as an adult, and of course Godzilla, I think, ties into that. I don't know that you would necessarily consider Godzilla to be tokusatsu, because I think tokusatsu also requires you to have the transforming hero. Like, I think that's actually part of the genre convention. But again, I'm not super well versed in it, and it doesn't really matter for our purposes today. Just letting you know this is the Ultraman that we're talking about, the Japanese Power Rangers type character. The Rise of Ultraman was written by Kyle Higgins and Matt Groom, with art by Francesco Manna, colors by Espen Grundet... Oof, oh boy. Didn't practice this one before we started recording. Espen Grundetjern, letters by Ariana Maher from Virtual Calligraphy. And there were some backup stories to the first issue that were illustrated, one of them was illustrated by Michael Cho, and it kind of shows the origins of the organization that came to be called the United Science Patrol. Then there were some kind of cute little one-off stories that were kind of meant to be training manuals for people who are members of the Science Patrol that were illustrated by Guru Hero. So, you know, that's fun. Anyway, let's actually get to the plot here. So, when things start, you kind of think that our main character is going to be this young woman named Kiki Fuji who just made it into the USP. She is now part of this elite group that is tasked with tracking down these supernatural creatures that pop up and, you know, cause mischief called kaiju. Kiki's best friend is a young man named Shin Hayata, who wanted to join the USP. In flashback, we see that they actually had a run-in with the USP when they were kids, and they were so excited and inspired by that experience that it became their lifelong dream to join up with the USP and fight monsters. Shin Hayata, unfortunately, washed out, and so he's a little bit envious of his friend who is now doing all of this exciting stuff, and he's not able to. He winds up kind of tagging along with her. He's giving her a ride somewhere when she gets called to an emergency mission. So he pals along. His old instructor is there, who was the one who kind of kicked him out. And he's like, we're desperate. Come along. Let's go. What they've been called in to investigate is a crashed UFO. And this giant, mysterious creature appears out of the wreckage of the UFO and kind of reaches out to the group. Shin shoots him and mortally wounds him, but then feels bad about it, they reach out and make a connection, and it turns out that this being is from a race of supernatural creatures called Ultras, who have transcended all mortal frailty and have dedicated their entire existence now to encouraging other peoples to do the same, or, if they cannot, to assist them as they fight off the kaiju. Together, Shin and Ultra learn the dark secrets of the USP, the main one being that the primary weapon that they use to fight the kaiju doesn't actually destroy the kaiju, but it transports them to this pocket dimension. Kiki winds up getting transported to the pocket dimension and having to kind of fight her way out. Ultra and Shin, they merge into a being that they call Ultraman. Ultraman fights off the kaiju, goes into the pocket dimension, saves Kiki, and then together with the USP, with this defector from the USP who couldn't stand the USP doing these kind of immoral things that they'd been doing, like the whole, everybody teams up to come up with this plan to release all of the kaiju from this pocket dimension in a very controlled way. If they don't do anything, it's going to explode and there's just going to be kaiju everywhere and there are not enough Bounty paper towels to clean that all up. But if it's controlled, they can cause all of the kaiju to imprint on Ultraman so that they will come out, they'll come out gradually, and when they do, they will beeline towards Ultraman so that they can kind of control this flow and thus create this narrative, give people a hero to believe in because they will see Ultraman fighting the monsters on their behalf, and it will be in a controlled way, in a way that inspires hope and confidence in people. And by so doing, it's implied, I think, that this is how they're going to inspire people to be better and transcend as Ultra and his people did. Even though Ultra doesn't think they're capable of it, ultimately this is like the Power Ranger Superman guy. Whew. Okay, I think that's a pretty good summary. What did you think of this book?
The art felt very Dotson-esque, and that's a compliment.
Yeah. Yeah. I really enjoyed the colors, too. It didn't grab me, like on paper, the description of this story. Like, you know, I enjoy what the little of this genre that I've seen. I was never into the Power Rangers, but I liked Pacific Rim, and that's, you know, it's fighting kaiju, and I love the Godzilla movies. Well, hold on, that's not true. I liked the newest Godzilla movie, and I liked the parts
that's,
where
that's Godzilla... That's Godzilla Minus One, right?
No, sorry. I still haven't seen that one. I liked the kind of Bryan Cranston one, because he dies, like, in the first third, but that one was good.
Oh, so like, not the real Godzilla, then, right?
Not American the real Godzilla. The American...
You like new American Godzilla?
Oh gosh, yeah.
Hey, those movies are pretty good. The ones that I've seen, I've enjoyed them.
That one movies. Is the only one
I
like.
I just like
the yeah, just... like King of the Monsters and Godzilla versus Kong. Like everything that wasn't big dinosaur fights was stupid. Like I didn't care about any of the human characters in the second two. I was like, I don't want to know what these people are up to. I just want to see Mothra again. So
I just like to joke around about that because I love Godzilla. I've watched a bunch of the original movies, so like I like to pretend that I'm a snob. I'm not. I love those movies, the American ones.
Hard to tell when you're joking. Hard to tell.
Yeah, a little. I'm sorry.
But yeah, it just. I don't know. I thought it was like, you know, well drawn, obviously. The colors were like really, sorry. I thought it was really well drawn, obviously, and the colors were really just like bright and dynamic and everything. But I don't know. It just didn't grab me. I don't know. Maybe I need to reread it.
Yeah.
So I will. You go ahead, Alda.
I was going to say, yeah, as somebody who actually has seen a little bit of like Ultraman, like a little bit of classic Ultraman, a little bit of the new Shin Ultraman movie that came out not too long ago, and some of the anime stuff spinoff, I agree with John that I had a hard time getting hooked into this one, even with like that pre-existing knowledge. I think by the end of the book I was a little bit more on board. And I don't know how well this mashes or like is copying or inspired by the original Ultraman mythos. Cause I don't know a whole lot about that. I don't think they're called Ultras. I will say that much. But I don't know for sure either. So I don't know. I did end up liking it. I did like that Shin had like this really interesting moral dilemma and kind of wrestling with what he wants versus what he needs to do, you know, being part of the USP and now being bonded to Ultra and, you know, becoming this Ultraman and, you know, what is he doing here, right? Like, does he help protect the government's secrets and help keep people calm, or does he like out that stuff and more openly address the issue while possibly causing more mayhem? Like, that was kind of an interesting dilemma for him to have towards the end. And they have, you know, what seems like an interesting solution for it that hopefully gets expanded on in the later books, because there's like two or three more series of this afterwards.
Yes.
So I overall liked it, but yeah, I had a hard time getting hooked. I think if I had been picking this up monthly, I don't know that I would have followed through.
Yeah, the opening is rough. It's three issues, I think, before we really get to see Ultraman in action. And the first issue doesn't really follow Ultraman. It follows Kiki. And I didn't hate that in the sense that, like, where the book ends, I like this ensemble that they've got together of these scientists in this coalition who don't trust each other, the childhood friend who has the skills to be part of this, I guess, paramilitary organization, has the conscience and the heart that makes her sympathetic and kind of has this connection with the friend who ultimately does wind up being the main character. The friend, Shin, is not the most interesting character, but the way that he merges with Ultraman is interesting. The moral conundrum, the sort of judgment where Ultra like is judging the whole species based off of the horrible treatment that he and his kind have had at humans. Something I didn't mention in the summary is that this isn't the first time an Ultra has come to Earth. The first time that Ultra also got shot and killed. So it's like there's all of this moral complexity, great group dynamics. It takes so long to get there, and then when that's all finally in place, we get the big action sequences where Ultra is fighting the giant robot, you know, the giant monster. He's grown to giant size. They're fighting in like Tokyo Bay or whatever. And I just was watching or reading that and just thinking, this would look so much better if it was two grown men in rubber costumes.
Yeah. No, I agree. I actually, on that note...
You think that's a joke, no, it's, but it's yeah. not.
On that note, though, I do appreciate how a lot of the kaijus do look like they're meant to be a person in a rubber suit from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a really nice touch.
It is. And it's something I was really thinking about, how much the charm of tokusatsu tends to come from the just audacity of thinking that this looks cool. It's like you fake it so hard that it's like, well, yeah, okay, it's pretty cool in its own way. It's like, okay, Power Rangers. I've watched a little bit of Power Rangers as an adult. I tried to get back into it because I did try to revisit a lot of things from my childhood of my own free will rather than having them sold to me. And the Power Rangers stories are bad because they went through, again, we're talking this era of, you know, Fox 13. You couldn't say but on television. You just very, very, everything had to be very watered down. But the just... surprising delight of seeing these costumes. That's a pumpkin in with like, there's a guy in a pumpkin costume who raps. It's just so audacious and so ridiculous that it goes all the way around the circle and just winds up being pretty cool. Even again, if the stories are bad, the voice acting, the dubbing that they do over the Japanese portions of it, just all of it's awful. There is something about those character designs and those costumes and the choreography and the giant, I quote, giant, you know, monster fights with the buildings that are just made of cardboard and they've got little, like, fireworks that go off. Like, it's fun. And there's a weird sort of dynamism to it that is difficult to translate to comics, which is funny because comics are a very dynamic medium. It's very easy to portray big action in comics. It just lacks the stuff that makes tokusatsu really charming.
Yeah, that's... I don't know. I was like, that's when I decided, like when I was a kid, when Power Rangers came out in the States, I was like, no, I can't. No, I'm you know, this is not my thing. Feels silly, but that's where I decided, like, you know, I was okay with Ninja Turtles and I'm done with Power Rangers and stuff. And so... I don't know. I came to it late where it's never been a guy in a rubber suit. It's always been, you know, big CG where it's really trying to like, you know, okay, this is a real animal that could really happen or whatever. Or like,
A bit of a side note on that. One of my favorite clips is like a behind the scenes of one of the original like Godzilla movies, like the first generation of them. And it's a person in like one of the monster suits. And it's like the stunt actress, and she's doing the growls that they're eventually going to ADR over.
I'm gonna have to. I've seen that before.
Yeah, so like this monster.
You may have shared it before.
Yeah, this little just Japanese woman's voice going like rawr, rawr.
I should have left one in.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't know. I think I like this. Not that it's so surprising that we're having similar thoughts to this as we did with, oh, what was the Kyle Higgins book that we read an episode?
Dark Hawk.
Where it feels like there's a lot of potential. There's a lot of good setup here. It feels like the first book that we get is set up for sort of something that could be really good. And that kind of feels the same here. Where by the time that we end the book, we're like, ooh, this could be really good. This is really interesting. There's some interesting moral dilemmas. There's some character growth. There's like a kind of a goal now. And, you know, like right, that's when it ends. It's like just when you're really kind of starting to like get that hook is really kind of coming in. And there's a really good twist at the end, I thought, where the guy who crashed on with the first Ultra ship appears in like modern day, like somewhere else in the world, And he's Yeah, he's like, where am I? I was like, oh, no, don't show me that now.
Yeah, that was a good jumping off point and piqued my interest for more of this. And then it ended. I was like, oh, dang it. So, yeah. Good cliffhanger. Does its job effectively where I want to, you know, read the next one when there just wasn't one.
Yeah, that was a genuinely good cliffhanger. So
this should have been one issue.
Yeah.
This whole book?
This whole 6-issue miniseries should have been one issue. Because its ending is so good. Like, I'm actually really, really high on the ending. And not just the twist where the guy who accidentally killed the first Ultra turns up again. I'm talking, like, the way that fight ends in the... I don't know if it's actually Tokyo Bay.
I think it's San Francisco. But like, isn't it Golden... No, no, that was Deadpool with a Golden Gate Bridge. Never mind.
Yeah.
But this ending with Ultraman's kind of narration going, I screen grabbed it. He's saying to himself, we are all scared, but to get through this, we need forgiveness for one another, for our fears, and then we must forgive ourselves. Like, it has this great blending of superhero action with, I don't want to say moral education necessarily, because that sounds very puritanical, but, you know, I like superhero comics that encourage people and inspire people to be the best version of themselves. It is the reason Superman is good.
Yeah.
It's the reason that, like, honestly, Spider-Man is good. Heck, most of my favorite superhero stories are, in some way or another, inspirational, as much as they are aspirational, mm-hmm. wish fulfillment, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And Ultraman gets to that point at the end of issue 6. At the end of issue 5.
Right.
The whole thing should have been one issue, and then we should have had 4 more issues of them actually delivering on that.
Yeah.
My hot take is that comics are too decompressed.
Which is the exact opposite of the problem that we had with Deadpool.
kind of. Yeah. Yeah.
We're just never happy with what we're presented.
No, but you know, and I think one of the things that will be a little disappointing to me in the other books, that was a little disappointing here, and maybe for the best actually, is some of the goofy fights that they have to do with like the very terrible like 60s special effects that I think adds so much charm to the original show.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. you know, different mediums, so you know, do what works for the medium, right? But I think as somebody who has partaken a little bit in the original content, that will be interesting to see how they do that. Because this fight was pretty quick. Like, he goes up to the big kaiju, kind of punches it a couple times. Then, like, grabs the ropes, the suspension ropes off of the bridge to, like, kind of lasso the monster and throw him and then do the ultra beam. Like, really cool. I think that works a lot better for the comics than it would in an actual Ultraman show or movie. But, yeah, I do want to see more. I do want to see more of this.
Yeah, like, I was going to suggest that we put the other, at least the next book, on our list to read at some point. Because I'm worried. I thought that Man of Steel set up a really good Superman story, and then that got followed up with my least favorite superhero movie, possibly.
I am curious, because, again, I'm going to talk about Radiant Black like I did last time we had a Kyle Higgins book. I felt that when he was able to kind of get past the intro of Radiant Black, there was some really interesting stuff that was kind of building up. It was able to keep the momentum that he builds. Because I think that's something that he's good at and not the best way. He's able to build good momentum so that by the time you finish the story, you're like, oh, you're more excited about it at the end than you were at the beginning. Which,
mm-hmm.
you know, for a format or a market that requires you to sell chapter by chapter, maybe not the best skill. But I am curious to see how, if it is the same team, which I'm assuming it is, if they can kind of follow through with what we have at the end here. Like, that will be an interesting thing to see.
I continue to think that I don't know, maybe Kyle Higgins' talents are better put to use in stories that are not superheroes.
Hmm. Yeah.
It's not that his stories are bad, and it's not that he's a bad writer. It's just, I feel like if you're setting it up as a superhero story, there are certain expectations that these books that we've been reading don't quite deliver on.
Yeah. I think this one's closer to his wheelhouse of what he wants to do.
Yeah. I would say that I probably liked this a little better than Darkhawk.
Yeah.
So,
I think Kyle Higgins needs to work, not just not hero books, like explicitly hero books. I think he does well in his own property. I don't think he works as well under the restraints of like canon or established characters.
See, I haven't read any of his own stuff, but now I want to, because I read a Nightwing run that he did. I think as part of the New 52, I think. Mm-hmm. And I liked that, you know, over DC. And I don't think any of the stuff we've read from him is bad necessarily, but maybe I need to compare it with, you know, his creator-owned stuff to kind of see how it compares with, you know, his...
Yeah. And I would say if you have a chance to read like the Radiant Black stuff, which I know they've done that in like a Humble Bundle, which I don't think is available anymore. Mm-hmm. But if you get a chance to read that, I would recommend it, because especially like these last two books that we've read really feel like this is maybe what got him to do that. Like maybe doing these two books and feeling whatever restrictions he was feeling. He was just like, screw it. I'll make my own tokusatsu.
Yeah.
And to your note about the whole kind of inspirational hero stuff, I know Ultraman does tend to lean a little bit more into the we have to show Ultraman and his species that we are ultimately like a good people, and that even though we stumble and fall, we get up and we improve and we better ourselves. Like, if I remember, that's part of the messaging in a lot of Ultraman stuff. I wonder if there is a correlation between Ultraman specifically and like Superman comics.
I've wondered that too, because it felt like reading Superman.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
So that feels like a true thing, but I, again, have very little experience with Ultraman outside of that one time that I got the COVID shot and was laid up.
I recommend the Shin Ultraman movie as like as like a standalone movie, mostly because it works standalone and it's very much like, hey kids, this is that thing your dad likes. But also because it comes from Hideaki Anno and friends, the special effects are very much like what your dad likes, which is to say, not very good.
No, that one Shin Godzilla wasn't 100% my thing, but it was interesting enough that I want to watch the other one. He did okay. So there was a Shin Godzilla, Shin Ultraman. There was a third one.
Shin
Kamen Rider, that's right.
Yeah.
I know even less about Kamen Rider than I do about Ultraman.
Same. Kamen Rider's still going. It's goofy.
Yeah, well, Ultraman keeps getting reboots, so...
Yeah.
You know, it's not that surprising.
Yeah, side note before we move on is that Shin Ultraman is, I think, only produced by Anno, and it's directed by, like, his right-hand guy. I forgot his name. But he's also the same guy who did the live action adaptations of Attack on Titan, which are not very good adaptations of Attack on Titan, but they're very good tokusatsu movies. Very goofy.
I was watching the live action adaptation of Yu Yu Hakusho on Netflix. It's not very good, especially compared to the live action adaptation of One Piece.
I've heard the fight scenes are really good though.
The fight choreography is really good. Some of the costuming is actually pretty good. And there are still moments that get to me. John, you don't know Yu Yu Hakusho, so this is mostly for your benefit. Yu Yu Hakusho
You assume I don't. You assume I don't know this random anime that you're talking about. You assume it all sounds.
No,
like
I didn't assume. I deduced it.
Your silence speaks volumes.
Yeah. Okay. You got me.
The opening chapters of this story are about. So Yu Yu Hakusho is about this kid who dies and gets brought back to life as a spirit detective. So he gets to go fight monsters on behalf of the afterlife.
Tales old as time.
Yeah, it's like right, it's like Dick Tracy if he threw hands with the devil.
And if the Grim Reaper was a hot chick with blue hair. But the kind of the twist is that the main character is just kind of an awful guy. He's like a street punk. He's a gangster. Like he wears like I guess his costume is just like his school uniform, but he's kind of coded as a member of like a street gang, and his rival is another like gang member, and they get in fights all the time, and he just causes nothing but problems for his best friend. He's a trouble student. His mom is too tired of life to do anything with him. His dad's AWOL. So anyway, he's in addition to being kind of just like this messed up kid, he is a jerk. He goes around, he causes trouble. But then he dies because he sees a kid is about to get hit by a car, and he jumps in front of the car to shove the kid out of the way, and the car hits him and he dies. And so they bring him back to life because it's like, there's no room for you. We didn't think you were going to die this day. You run that simulation a million times and you never would have done that. You're not that selfless. But he does a selfless thing anyway. And so there is, it's again, there's kind of this, you know, heart to this story. And he's such a punk that when, you know, God basically tells him, you know, we're going to send you back to Earth and you get to come back to life and we just need you to do some stuff for us. He's like, nah, I'll pass. I don't want to do what you tell me. But ultimately he decides to come back because they let him go see his funeral. And his funeral, it's like all of his classmates are there, and they're all there because their teachers are making them, and they don't care that he's dead. And he's just like, whatever, this is nonsense. And then his mom breaks down and is like, I miss you, come back. And then his friend breaks down. It's like, why do you have to be such a jerk? I miss you. His principal shows up and is, you know, devastated. He's like, this kid had such potential. I just couldn't get through to him in time. I'm sorry. And then his rival, that other gangster that he's been fighting with, shows up and he starts screaming. He's like, how dare you die before I get a chance to beat you? Those two characters are very coded as gay for each other. But it's... like in the live action, that scene got me. So I'm sitting there, I'm watching this while I'm donating platelets, and so I'm like lying on a table with needles sticking out of my arm, and I can't move my arms because I've got needles in them. But I'm just bawling in the middle of this. It's very ridiculous. Anyway, it's not good, but it still makes me cry. But that's not hard. Everything makes me cry. Let's rank these comics.
Rankings make Steven cry.
He's like,
oh. Not yet.
Yeah, once Ms. Marvel is taken out of our top spot, which that's not going to happen, but if it were, Steven will shed mighty tears.
It's possible.
I'm optimistic. Possible. I like to believe that there's something out there better. Not because it's bad, obviously, because we think it's very good. I just have that sort of hope that the comics industry will, or specifically Marvel...
Yeah.
will surprise me and make me cry again like a little boy.
Yeah.
Just crying out for his mother, just wanting support and love and emotional connection to the world. It's not even Evangelion, anyway, what I'm saying.
Anyway, speaking of connection, let's connect these stories to our list. Which currently has 277 entries on it. I'm not going to bother with the super top of the list because I don't think it gets there. Sort of what has historically been the middle of the road, like, you must be better than this comic to be a good comic. Star Wars A New Hope manga. That's not entirely fair because there's still a lot of good books beneath that, but that's kind of been our benchmark for, like, this is a good book that you want to read to know how good comics work, and everything above that is almost like a must read. That is at currently number 130. So a little bit higher than halfway on our list. I don't think either of these stories go that high, but I'm open. Because again, even though I had very little good to say about Deadpool, I don't think I hated it. Where do we want to rank Dead Presidents?
Stay Angry is at 132. And that tonally, I think, goes along with this. But I don't know, that might still be a little high. Storytelling-wise, and like Demon Bears at 148. We start to get into kind of the slightly problematic sections here where things could be done a little bit better. Steven, my document is actually messed up. Can you see what's at 171?
No.
It's so weird. Aldo, can you see it? 171?
It's glitching out for me, I think. I do see that. I think Steven can hover over it,
though. He must be the only owner of the file. That's what's going on
here. Yeah, I think it's some permissions issue, probably.
So number 171 is The Search for Eternity by Doctor Strange.
I don't think that's...
It's not by Doctor Strange. It's about Doctor Strange.
Ooh. That's not the name of the book.
I'm sorry. The Search for Eternity! Exclamation point.
Oh, that doesn't seem right either. Yeah, you are stuck in the mud. Are you wearing...
We're done with this podcast, I'm going to go put my bathrobe on.
Do you have a rolled-up newspaper to swing at kids?
No, man, I'm a millennial curmudgeon. We don't have newspapers. I'm going to get out there with my BlackBerry.
with his iPad, Gen 1.
I think that's a Gen... Yeah, I was going to say, I was like, that's probably Gen X or something.
Oh my gosh, I do have a second-generation iPad mini somewhere around here.
Yeah. Or he's instead of a rolled-up newspaper, he's going to walk out with his Pokemon card binder.
Oh, I was gonna say, he's just gonna yell out, like, you know, recording kids and being like, I got you. Anyway, I don't know if this is not bad, but also should not go higher than like stories like Steven said that are must reads, or like The Search for Eternity, like, or House of M just above it, kind of, you know, benchmark books. And some of these are benchmarks that we didn't like as much. And I don't know. I liked this, so I'm going to skew it a little higher. So I would leave it to you all to, you know, find out where the bottom is. But
how do we like this Dead Presidents book compared to Avengers versus X-Men?
I would rather read AVX again.
Yeah, same.
Okay.
Although they're actually doing an AVX event on Marvel Snap right now, and it reminds me how much I don't actually like AVX.
See, I
like one of the promo cards you can get is Cyclops in his Penis 5 costume, and it's no good because that costume's bad.
I forget about that.
Was that a Freudian slip, or did
no? No. Every time we talk about AVX, we have to go through this.
It's the first letter of the names of the five Phoenix Force people.
Hold on, that can't be right. Piotr, Emma.
Every time Piotr,
Namor,
Emma,
Ilyana, and Scott. Oh my gosh!
every time, John.
Sorry, some jokes are evergreen because
how is this not a traumatic core memory for you like it is for me?
On topic, how do we feel about this versus Deadpool Bullseye?
That one was more fun, I think, without being inundated by jokes. Because they used flashbacks where there was a build up to a punchline. Not just jokes being chucked at you like, you know, you're in a batting cage or something getting hit by them. I would be okay with this, like, right under that and above Death of Wolverine. Because Death of Wolverine was very meh. Just very, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'm leaning a little bit lower. Where I actually start to struggle is when we get to 179, 180. Like, I'm pretty sure I like this better than Old Man Logan.
Yeah.
I could probably be talked a little bit higher than that.
I feel like I have a hard time putting this above Xavier Must Die.
Which one was Xavier Must Die? Is that the Extreme X-Men?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You know what? I like that as a ceiling. So I would say let's put this between 177, between Xavier Must Die and Big Thunder Mountain Railroad.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Still haven't seen the Ryan Reynolds movies either.
Really?
Yeah, same. I've never seen Deadpool.
Any of them. I feel like they actually address your problem with Deadpool, where like he doesn't have a personal life.
I don't know that that makes the character better, but I would have to see it.
I think you'd be surprised.
Yeah, it's fair. I could be very surprised. Although surprises aren't always good. Anyway, Rise of Ultraman. Rise of Ultraman is better by a fair bit in my mind. And I think it might... I don't know that the ending by itself is good enough to get it past the Star Wars New Hope manga line.
No.
It's definitely...
Because it's such a slow start.
It's definitely a little better than Darkhawk.
Yes, I do believe it's better than Darkhawk.
Which is 149.
It's not as good as that Squirrel Girl story where Squirrel Girl travels through time and recruits a bunch of other Squirrel Girls to fight Dr. Doom and he throws them off and recreates the panel from Squirrel Girls first. It's not better than that.
Then I would put it above Arrow... but below Photon, which is still higher than I think it should go, because I didn't really like it that much. But
yeah.
I know how this triumvirate works.
I would be maybe tempted to put it above, I would maybe even go a little bit higher than that. It is definitely, definitely not better than that Vader to the letter, which was, again, like...
Oh, yeah.
Big problem with Rise of Ultraman is that it's too... There's not enough plot for the five issues. To the Letter was a really solid one issue done.
That was so good.
I mean, it wasn't that good because we didn't put it that high, but...
I mean, in the context of the books here, that was so good.
In the context of the books here, it's pretty good.
In the context especially of all these things, we've rated lower than it. It was really good.
Yeah. It's better than, like, 200 of the books, okay?
Yes, that's how numbers work.
But yeah, at this point, we're quibbling over, like, five different spaces, so I'm not...
What was Daredevil Roulette? What are you thinking?
Daredevil Roulette was the story where Daredevil sits in the hospital with Bullseye and they play Russian Roulette.
Yeah, and he comes out looking like a jerk face, which, I mean, he kind of
a
is.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Fitting for Daredevil.
Yeah. Oh, man. See, I have a hard time kind of putting this above FF1234. Not that FF1234 was amazing, obviously, because it's down here. But it was pretty novel in like how it told its story, and Ultraman is pretty straightforward, all things considered.
I think it goes under that.
Yeah, I think
I'd have to agree. Under Photon, even.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree with John on this one. Probably below Photon, above Arrow.
Yeah, I agree with above Arrow. So let's put that. That's the new number 141 between Photon and Arrow Before the Storm.
All right.
Yeah. Arrow's not that good in Marvel Snap anymore anyway.
Man, what are they going to add Ultraman to Marvel Snap?
Can't.
Literally today they added War Machine and he's pretty good.
No, I haven't seen that yet. I've been playing with it with the AVX thing. I chose X-Men. I would like to get the Hope Summers card, but yeah, nothing yet.
Yeah, I've got enough tokens. They usually put the season pass card up in the token shop the week after the season ends. So next week, I'm planning on getting Hope. I've actually gotten most of the season pass, or most of the new cards this month. I missed Pixie. I really like Cannonball. Cannonball's not very good, but I like him. I like that style of play.
Yeah.
I was really hoping to get War Machine today. I've still got a couple of spotlight keys that are coming up, so I'm going to try to crack War Machine this week. And then Mockingbird has been really good, so much so that I wanted to read a story. So for our next time, we're going to read Mockingbird. Again, she recently got released on Marvel Snap. Pretty good card. The Marvel Comics story of Mockingbird. We're going to read the first five issues of her 2016 series, which was written by Chelsea Kane. If I recall correctly, Chelsea Kane got in a bit of hot water at some point, so we might need to look into that a little bit. I remember the series being okay, though. And anyway, it's a double feature. For our second book, we're going to revisit the Loeb Sale collaborations and read the six-issue series Hulk Gray from 2003. Not sure that those two stories have a whole lot in common other than they are both stories that at least one of us has read before.
As good a reason as any.
I mean, we are all old and don't have time for new things, so we just revisit old things over and over and over and over again.
I like it when it's repackaged and sold back to me at a premium.
Or as part of a monthly subscription.
Yeah, or part of a monthly subscription. Yeah, exactly. It's the best. Yeah. I love seeing my childhood be commercialized and itemized and sold.
Speaking of itemizing things, we have a list that we itemized. We're doing it. Uh-huh. We're part of the problem.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We should get a Patreon.
I'm sorry, were you saying something? All I heard was you Patreon.
Yeah, I heard Patreon. I was like, are you planning something? What?
I said we should get a Patreon so that we can be even more part of the problem by monetizing it.
I'm not a Makati.
I think that's a good place to is any.